sort of come back to the drawing board a bit on how to look at this project a bit differently.
Governor Walker announces potential changes to the Alaska LNG project. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the BLM announces plans to clean up the most hazardous abandoned oil and gas wells on its land in the state.
One that's going to be plugged this year has been leaking hydrocarbon gases into the environment for years.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Alaska Regional Hospital, with hospital-wide renovations and upgrades, it's a brand new day at Alaska Regional Hospital.
Changes are coming to state plans for the liquefied natural gas pipeline. At a press conference this morning in Anchorage, leaders with ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips joined Governor Bill Walker to announce they are exploring options to advance the pipeline, APRN's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Governor Bill Walker and executives with the state's three pipeline partners aren't ready to say what changes they're considering to the massive AK LNG plant. Walker emphasized the importance of keeping the project on track.
We know that most likely we need to be some modification in some way. So we sort of come back to the drawing board a bit on how to look at this project a bit differently.
The executive said they would complete preparations for front-end engineering and design work, known as pre-FEED, on schedule by this fall. But ConocoPhillips Alaska President Joe Marushak didn't offer assurances beyond a commitment to explore options.
What we're trying to do is get through the pre-FEED process. Clearly, the economic headwinds are pretty tough right now, but we've got to see what the project costs before we can make a statement one way or another about if we should participate and go forward or not.
Energy industry experts have said the project doesn't make economic sense at today's natural gas prices. The announcement put into doubt the state's timeline for the project. State Natural Resources Deputy Commissioner Marty Rutherford says everything is on the table ahead of another pipeline announcement next month.
It's a sort of a nexus of problems that have happened. This economic situation on the value of oil and gas right at the moment, as well as slow negotiations, which has caused everybody to begin to discuss, well, you know, as we continue forward on AKLNG as currently envisioned, are there other alternatives we should be looking at to ensure that we don't have a delayed FEED decision?
Walker earlier said he would seek a state constitutional amendment to lock in tax rates for the energy companies who are working with the state on the project. The governor said he isn't ruling out the amendment, but the state may be able to provide cost certainty without an amendment. The project has an estimated cost of $45 billion to $65 billion. Speaker of the House Mike Chenault said he wished there was something more concrete from today's announcement. The Nikiski Republican added that he welcomes greater scrutiny of the cost of the project, which is the largest proposed infrastructure project in the world.
I don't know whether to take it as a sign of good or bad. I think we take it as a sign that they're still talking. And, you know, in the economic times that we're in with the price of a barrel of oil, I think that it might do us well to step back and look at it and make sure that that we hadn't missed something that may cost us in the future.
Kenai Peninsula Borough Oil and Gas Advisor Larry Persily says the options may include changing the percentage ownership that each partner has in the pipeline. Persily previously was the federal coordinator for natural gas projects in the state. He says that if some of the partners decide to scale back their participation in the project, it will present a dilemma for the state.
Right now, the state, I think, wants it more than the others. But when it comes down to it, the state is not in a position to take on more risk than the companies could afford. We have enough of a financial hole in our budget.
Persily adds that if the state wants to borrow money, it will have to show lenders that it can pay the bills that it already has. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
More than 100 abandoned oil wells dot the tundra on federal land on the North Slope, and efforts to clean them up have been delayed for decades. Now the Bureau of Land Management has launched an ambitious plan to clean up many of the wells that are the highest priority hazards. Alaska Public Media's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Steve Cohn, Deputy Director of Resources for BLM Alaska, says the wells were drilled during the 1940s and 50s by the U.S. Geological Survey and the U.S. Navy before the lands were transferred to BLM to administer as the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska.
These wells have really always been a federal responsibility. They were drilled by federal agencies for the purpose of trying to determine what the resources are in the area, but it's now our responsibility as well to make sure that these wells are properly cleaned and remediated.
The risks posed by the wells are highly variable, according to Kathy Forster, chair of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission.
One that's going to be plugged this year has been leaking hydrocarbon gases into the environment for years. Some have all kinds of surface debris, including old drilling mud that's probably caused ground contamination. One site has hundreds of drums.
Some are located in subsistence hunting areas and could pose a danger to human health. In 2013, BLM received $50 million from the Helium Stewardship Act. The agency has spent $10 million of those funds to plug three of the so-called legacy wells at Umiat within NPRA and to conduct surface cleanup near Cape Simpson east of Barrow. Nicole Hayes, Legacy Wells Project Coordinator, says since 2002, 68 wells have been cleaned up or do not need further action, while 18 of them are still being used by the USGS to monitor Arctic climate change.
And then 50 wells are the ones that we've focused on as needing some level of remediation, whether it's surface or subsurface.
BLM's program will target 18 of those wells for work this year. Hayes says the remaining $40 million from the Helium Fund money will be used on contracts with Marsh Creek and Alunik Construction. The wells needing work have been prioritized in collaboration with the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. The logistics of the work make it expensive. Hayes says it takes $2 to $3 million just to mobilize to the sites due to the heavy equipment needed. And Rob Brumbaugh, a former well remediation coordinator, says records on the wells either were lost or not kept at all.
When we go to plug these wells, we don't really know what we're getting into. We have some, you know, some rough ideas based upon some of the studies that are still around. But you're dealing with, you know, old wellhead components that may or may not be functioning. You're dealing with old casing, which may or may not be collapsed.
Brumbaugh says ice has plugged many of the wells, and that has to be removed before cement plugs can be put in. Hayes says to date, BLM and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers have spent $99 million on plugging and cleaning up 21 of the wells. She says the cleanup program has been made possible by the efforts of Senator Lisa Murkowski to secure funding. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Siberian huskies are generally slower than their Alaskan husky relatives, so why run the Iditarod with a Siberian-only team?
Everything about them is efficient and suited for travel in cold weather.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski returned to Juneau and delivered her annual address this morning to the Alaska legislature. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Murkowski tucked her Senate accomplishments into a speech that was decidedly homey and reassuring.
Murkowski walked into the House chamber, where she used to serve, and added a flower to a vase sitting on Representative Max Gruenberg's desk. The Anchorage lawmaker died Sunday. Murkowski told legislators she feels the loss.
And my heart's with Kayla and the family and with you, because Max was our family. You know, Max was part of the Alaska family.
Then, as she usually does, Murkowski gave an update on her kids. The older son is in law school, the younger just graduated from college, and both intend to move back to Alaska. Murkowski says, as a mom, she's proud. And here's the pivot.
It's also a responsibility, then, for me to make sure that we maintain an economy here. We maintain a quality of life that not only brings my boys home, but brings all of our kids back home, or keeps those here so that they have that stability, that certainty.
That was the theme of her speech, certainty, and what she's doing to provide more of it for Alaska. She says all three members of the congressional delegation helped pass a six-year highway bill that will give Alaska certainty in federal transportation money, a steady ramp up to $585 million by 2021. Murkowski also talked about all the new military construction for Alaska, new buildings at military bases, more interceptor missiles at Greeley, a new radar system at Clear.
When you add it all up, this is about $561 million being poured into Alaska's construction economy. This is significant to us.
Murkowski barely took any credit for steering that money to Alaska, although she is one of the handful of senators who gets to write the military construction spending bill.
We're not getting these Milcon dollars just because I'm using my sharp elbows to say we need more up here.
She gave credit to the recognition of Alaska's strategic spot on the globe. Geography, she says, is also one of the lessons learned when she brought five U.S. senators to Bethel this week. Murkowski says someone, she didn't say who, asked if their field hearing ran late, could their staffers just drive them back from Bethel to Anchorage? No.
You need to kind of be in the space and the place to really appreciate it. And that was a strong takeaway for them.
Murkowski also says if the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't rule for an Anchorage moose hunter for state sovereignty in a pending hovercraft case, she'll work to change the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act to more clearly limit the reach of the federal government. It didn't sound like a partisan speech, and legislators on both sides of the aisle cheered her. Anchorage Democratic Senator Berta Gardner says she's impressed with Murkowski's work to protect Alaska's fisheries, like keeping Russian pollock from being sold under the name Alaska pollock.
And of course, on the military, she's absolutely bringing home the bacon and keeping that aspect of our economy and our state very healthy and strong.
Representative Dan Ortiz, an independent from Ketchikan, says the certainty Murkowski spoke of was a comfort to legislators as they grapple with big deficits. Ortiz says he also appreciates her account of the federal money coming to Alaska,
which is really important in relationship to the problem that we're having in our ability at the state level to come up with a significant capital budget. So I really liked a lot what she had to say today.
It's an election year for Murkowski, and she says it was news to her to learn that she has a new challenger, Margaret Stock, an Anchorage immigration attorney and a retired Army reservist. Stock says she'll run as an independent. For APRN, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Governor Bill Walker issued an administrative order Tuesday that transfers many functions of the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission into the Department of Fish and Game. The governor's office says the reorganization will save the state more than $1.3 million a year. The CFEC, an autonomous state agency, is responsible for deciding what commercial fisheries to limit, who gets to participate in them, and adjudicating appeal cases. It also issues permits and licenses, which bring in the majority of the agency's revenue. The administrative order moves CFEC's licensing, permitting, research, IT, accounting, payroll, procurement, and budget services to Fish and Game. This transfer would affect about a dozen of the commission's 25 employees. Fish and Game Deputy Commissioner Kevin Brooks says some vacancies and at least one office manager will be eliminated. Brooks says the reorganization will be done in phases.
We've got to do it orderly and make sure we maintain services to the fleet. And we don't want to do something that's going to disrupt issuing permits, to fishermen. We're not going to take any action that's going to compromise the ability of the folks doing the job to keep doing that job.
CFEC will retain its adjudication functions. Brooks says part of the $1.3 million in savings includes the three commissioner positions going from full-time to part-time in January 2017. Brooks says the ideal long-term solution is to move the 12 reorganized employees to Fish and Game headquarters. Police took a Homer resident into custody last week for growing a large crop of marijuana with the intent to sell it. The arrest comes just before the state is supposed to introduce its brand new commercial cannabis regulations. KBBI's Quinton Chandler has more.
Police arrested a Homer man last week for running the biggest marijuana grow operation in the city's history. That's according to Homer Police Chief Mark Roble.
You know, it's the largest grow I've seen in my over 30 years of law enforcement. I've heard of larger ones being taken down in the state, but this is the largest one I've been involved in and the largest one in Homer's history.
Police seized between $1 and $1.5 million worth of marijuana plants from a building leased by 32-year-old Joseph Gabrzak of Homer. Gabrzak arrived at the scene during the raid and was arrested. Officers seized 1,012 marijuana plants and 59 light ballasts. Light ballasts regulate the amount of electricity used by fluorescent lamps. According to a criminal complaint filed by Homer Police Sergeant Ryan Browning, the ballasts were worth about $25,000. Chief Roble estimates startup costs for the facility were around $50,000. Police first suspected the building in early February because its windows were blacked out and there was a strong marijuana smell coming from inside.
Very strong odor. It's very distinctive. And after you've been doing this for a few years, you know what you've got when you smell that. And then you walk closer to the building and the odor gets stronger and you can tell it's coming from within the building itself. It's very telling.
Gabrzak faces three felonies: intentionally manufacturing a Schedule 6A controlled substance, possession of more than 25 marijuana plants, and knowingly maintaining a building used to store controlled substances. Chief Roble says he could face as many as 15 years in prison. Sergeant Browning wrote in his report that Gabrzak admitted the operation was his and his alone, and that he financed the operation from his past earnings working road construction. Next week, state regulations go into effect allowing people who want to grow commercial cannabis to apply for licenses with the state. The Alcohol and Marijuana Control Board says those applications won't be available until the 24th. But freedom to apply isn't the same as freedom to grow or to sell.
Until someone actually has a permit in hand and their premises have been inspected in accordance with that permit and compliance is observed, they're not authorized to grow a single plant.
The Homer City Council is considering two ordinances regarding marijuana regulations. One would ban commercial marijuana altogether, and the other would allow marijuana businesses in specific areas, like the neighborhood off East End Road, where police made the bust. Gabrzak told police that it was about to be legal to grow marijuana, and he wanted to know if he could do it, according to court records. In Homer, I'm Quentin Chandler.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Full Circle, delivering organic produce and groceries across Alaska since 2006, featuring fresh pasta, coffee, fish, and baked items from Alaskan producers. More at fullcircle.com/APRN. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
In competitive mushing, not all sled dogs are created equal. As a breed, Alaskan Huskies dominate the top spots in high-profile races, but Siberian Huskies have a long tradition in Alaska. A family in Willow has been running a kennel for Siberians since the 1940s. And as Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, one of the youngest members of the Norris family is keeping the Siberian tradition alive as she prepares for her third Iditarod run.
Hi, Nils. Hi, buddy.
27-year-old Lisbeth Norris shows off the wide spectrum of sizes in her dog lot. She picks up the genial 9-year-old Nils that has run with her team twice all the way to Nome.
And what's interesting about the standard for Siberian Huskies is that it's relatively loose. So like Nils here is, I don't know, maybe 45 pounds. Oh!
The Norris family's lineage in Alaska is interwoven with the history of the Siberian breed itself.
I'm a third-generation dog musher. My family's kennel is called Alaskan Kennels, and we're the oldest Siberian Husky kennel in the world.
That claim and the name of the breed itself can be a little bit tricky. Siberians are actually an American breed. Their forebears were imported from the Anadyr region of far eastern Russia across the Bering Strait for the All-Alaska Sweepstakes Race by the sport's grandfathers like Victor Anderson and Leonard Seppala.
It's like 13 generations back. It's very direct. All Siberians can trace their lineage back to those dogs. But after the Sirim run, a lot of the mushers moved back east and they took their dogs with them. And so, the registry was established in the 30s, and that's kind of when the breed started.
Likewise, Norris's grandparents met on the edge of the same era. Her grandfather was living in Anchorage when someone mailed him a magazine showing a dark-haired beauty and a parka on the cover. And inside was an article about a young woman who ran dogs in Lake Placid, New York, getting ready to follow her mushing dreams to Alaska.
Grandpa read the article, and he immediately wrote, offering his help for when she arrived. And so when she came to Alaska, she kept her dogs at his place, and it wasn't too long after that they got married and started the kennel in Anchorage.
Norris's parents still mush. In fact, her dad competes in the Fur-Rondi sprint races with dogs from the same breeding pool as the younger Norris's long-hauling Iditarod squad. That versatility is one of the breed's strong suits, along with their physical traits.
Everything about them is efficient and suited for travel in cold weather.
That includes their thick double coats, small ears, tiny blood vessels, and tough paws. Norris is just one of a few mushers on the scene to race Siberians, which have the disparaging nickname Slowberians in some corners.
Siberians get a bad rep for being slow. Like there's this stereotype of them being very slow, heavy dogs.
That, she says, is a misconception, one that sometimes comes from people mistaking Siberians for larger, heavier Malamutes. But the highest finish for a Siberian team in recent Iditarods was 30th by Mike Ellis in 2013. As breeding programs and many high-profile kennels have become increasingly scientific in their trait selection, dedication to a purebred lineage may seem quaint. It's also a limiting factor. The breeding pool is just smaller, with significantly less polished stock to choose from in building out racing teams and kennels. Norris gets quite a few questions about whether she can remain true to the breed if she has aspirations of mushing in the sport's top echelons.
I get asked a lot by people like, well, if you ever wanted to be competitive, would you switch to Alaskans? And no, like I really, in like I love the breed, like I adore these dogs, and I enjoy, challenging myself and learning the limits of my team and doing the best with what we have.
Norris bends down to show off the molting top coat of a bright-eyed husky named Rip.
Hi, Rippers. Oh my gosh, except you're losing all your fur.
She offers a familiar comparison of her own abilities measured against the four-legged athletes on her Iditarod team.
And I know that, I am, without a doubt, the weak link.
Her devotion to Siberians seems less tied to pushing the boundaries of the sport than realizing the abilities of the breed itself. In Willow, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Yukon Quest mushers continue to come across the finish line, and competition is not just about winning the 1,000-mile race. KUAC's Molly Reddick has the story of the battle between two Quest mushers who finished nearly a day behind the winner.
Tom Froda Johansson arrived in Whitehorse Tuesday afternoon. He was the first rookie to finish, but not the first Scandinavian.
Oh, I see him coming up over. Give him a big thumbs up.
Johansson from Norway and Torsten Konert from Sweden have raced against each other before in Europe. This year, the rivalry played out between Fairbanks and Whitehorse. As Konert chased the leaders for hundreds of miles, Johansson was hot on his heels.
There's no way that the Norwegian guy is coming. It's passing me. Not here.
At first, Konert wasn't worried about Johansson. Konert had already run the quest twice, while Johansson was just a rookie. But then he noticed the Norwegian was quietly gaining on him. When they chatted at the checkpoints, Johansson would exaggerate about how long he was resting. He would claim that he was going to sleep for 5 hours, but really only stay for three. By sleeping less, he was slowly chipping away at Konert's lead. At first, Konert didn't know what was going on, because Johansson was behind him. Then, all of a sudden, his lead had dwindled to 1 hour.
He was cutting rest all the time, and it's 1 hour ahead. So he was lying to me all the time. I said, okay, sucker.
So Konert came up with his own plan. When he got to Pelly Crossing, he wrote a wake-up time of 5:45 a.m. on the board in the community center. When Johansson arrived an hour later, he looked at Konert's wake-up call and figured he could sleep for a while. But Konert was playing a trick. He waited until the Norwegian went to sleep, then grabbed his stuff and hit the trail.
He sneaked out on me. He did a little land smacky.
Johansson couldn't catch him, but he still clinched Rookie of the Year when he crossed the finish line Tuesday afternoon.
I'm very proud to be number one of the rookies.
The 54-year-old musher has been running dogs for more than half his life. Though he lives on the coast of Norway, he's wanted to mush in Alaska and Canada since he was a little boy. Standing in the finish chute, he said it had lived up to his hopes.
Oh, it was fantastic.
Unlike races in Norway, he had the trail to himself.
This is also one of the things with the race that I really enjoy. You don't see the mushes very much.
Early Tuesday morning, the finish chute was moved from downtown Whitehorse to the Takini Hot Springs outside town because of open leads on the Yukon River. Konert was just getting out of the hot springs when Johansson arrived. Besides getting charged by a moose near the 40-mile river, he said the quest was pretty tame this year.
Well, last year was really cold. The year before, it was clear ice and it was cold and it was more difficult. So this year was more just cruising along and have a nice trip.
He was hoping to finish in the top five, but said the competition was too stiff. The field included three former champions and a bunch of veterans.
They did a really good job. I mean, they were not resting a lot, so it's just, that was a little too much.
He was bittersweet about the ending.
It's nice to be done, but it's also a little sad that it's over.
About a dozen teams are still on the trail, spread across the last 200 miles. On the Yukon Quest Trail in Whitehorse, I'm Molly Redig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Ellen Lockyer and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Lisa Fu in Juneau, Quentin Chandler in Homer, and Molly Redig on the Yukon Quest Trail. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence,
and by
the University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
If you're looking for a career that will put you to work immediately without any educational debt, think about the apprenticeship program and learn to become a construction craft laborer. The construction industry requires hard work, provides great pay, and a bright future while building Alaska. Application deadline for the apprenticeship program is March 31st. Call to begin your debt-free career track today, 907-345-3853. This message sponsored by Alaska Laborers Training School.
Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.